Welcome to Found at TU, a monthly podcast where we talk with University of Tulsa faculty about their research, how they do it, why they love it, and what they are finding out. I'm Jolie Jensen, Hazel Rogers Professor of Media Studies at the University of Tulsa, and today we're here with Dr. Jennifer Airy, Associate Professor of English at the University of Tulsa, as well as the current editor of Tulsa Studies in Women's Literature, the first scholarly journal devoted to the study of women's writing. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Oh, I'm glad you're here. So can you tell us in one simple sentence what you study?
Broadly speaking, I study literature of the long 18th century, which is basically 1660 to about 1840. We claim a long breadth of time. But I'm particularly interested in women's writings and also in political propaganda, the relationship between women's writings and the politics of the time.
Oh, how interesting. So how did you get interested in this topic?
Well, the first book, which is called The Politics of Rape, Sexual Atrocity, Propaganda Wars, and the Restoration Stage, grew out of my dissertation project in graduate school. Mm-hmm. And I initially started because I was poking around in archives, and I started coming across all of these incredibly compelling, violent, horrible descriptions of the Irish Rebellion of 1641, which was a time in which Irish Catholics, there was an uprising against the Protestants in Ireland. And it was this incredibly traumatic experience for the culture as a whole that I don't think a lot of people are aware of now. Mm-hmm. And probably about 2,000 people were killed by modern estimates.
Wow.
At the time, they claimed that up to 300,000 were killed.
Hmm.
And you started getting these very, very violent descriptions of sexual atrocity, vampirism, cannibalism, just the worst things you can think of.
Now, these are memoirs or who's writing these?
So some of them were propaganda tracts that were being written to demonize the Catholics.
Ah.
But then in the 1650s, they actually went back and they had a commission interview all of the living witnesses. So there's actually a compendium of supposedly eyewitness accounts from the period that also testify to this horrific violence. And so when I discovered these tracts, I started to become very interested to think about the relationship between writings of the period and specifically theatrical representations, theater plays, and what was happening offstage in the culture.
So would it be reasonable to say that plays were the popular culture of the time?
They were a very big part of the popular culture of the time. You know, there were, ultimately, the theaters would be shut down during the time of the English Civil Wars, you know, because the Puritans were violently against theater.
Right.
But there was always this sort of underground theater culture that continued to exist.
Really?
Yeah, and then after the Restoration, after Charles II is reappointed king in 1660, the theater becomes sort of the predominant pop culture genre of the period.
And thus the plays would be trying to work on these traumatic events that have happened, are happening? Are they in the past and the present?
Both, right? Mm. It's a very tumultuous period. So, you know, you've just gotten through this incredibly violent sectarian period where all three kingdoms uprose, leading to the execution of Charles I, the monarch. Then we have the Restoration. So Charles II comes back. But then we're going to have another series of wars culminating in the Glorious Revolution in 1688. So it's just a very violent period of time, and we see that the playwrights are really trying to grapple with the effects of this kind of violence. How do you live with this kind of violence? How do we respond to it? How do we influence what's going on in the culture? There's a lot of interplay between what's happening on stage and the actual power makers of the time.
Wow. So who was writing these plays then?
So probably the most famous for modern audiences would be John Dryden, who often was commissioned by Charles II to write certain things in certain propaganda ways. A lot of other playwrights at the time are less famous, but they're super compelling, I think. So, you know, people like Nathaniel Lee, Aphra Behn, who's the first female playwright to make a living solely as an author. People like Edward Ravenscroft, other people you wouldn't have necessarily have heard of, but they deserve more attention.
From scholars, I presume, they probably couldn't make good plays today because they're so time-bound.
They are time-bound. I mean, I think that there's a modern resonance to it.
It sounds like
it. Yeah, I mean, we're in a very tumultuous political moment ourselves.
Yes.
And if we think about the ways in which our own popular culture is trying to respond to this era of tensions and violence, I think we can see its roots back in the 1600s.
Absolutely. So I know you're interested in women's writing in particular. Mm-hmm. So your first book was not necessarily focused on women's writing, but was on these larger connections between culture, cultural representation, historical events.
Mm-hmm.
So you got your dissertation written. Mm-hmm. You came here and wrote your first book.
Wrote the first book here,
And then?
So the second book, I actually sort of jumped from the late 1600s to the late 1700s, which mm-hmm. which was a little bit of a jump. But the same things fascinate me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the 1600s, you know, we have these moments of horrible sectarian violence. Well, we have that again in the late 1700s with the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. Napoleonic Wars are often referred to as the first instance of total war.
Really?
Yeah, so the first instance where it's about killing civilians indiscriminately, not just armies.
Using modern weapons.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. So the same sort of driving questions about politics and art followed me into the new project, which actually is about Mary Shelley, who of course is most famous for Frankenstein, but was the author of six other novels, all of which were really intimately interested in responding to these moments of crisis.
Tell us more about the Mary Shelley Project, basically. Mm-hmm. She's a fascinating figure, but mm-hmm. I think most people know her only as that or the wife of Percy Bysshe Shelley, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's she's such a fascinating person because we know her predominantly. And there was that movie that just came out with the young Mary Shelley. There's been a couple of other representations of the night that Frankenstein was composed, and that's sort of how we know her.
Mm-hmm.
Or we know her as the grieving widow.
Hmm.
But she was so much more than that. Most of her productivity actually happened after her husband was dead, in part because she needed to write to survive, right?
Uh-huh.
She was writing to support her family.
Mm-hmm.
And she went on to write the very first post-apocalyptic novel in science fiction.
Uh-huh.
It's called The Last Man. Everybody should read it. And she wrote in a whole bunch of different genres. She wrote historical fiction. She wrote domestic fiction, science fiction.
Following the market, you think, or?
A lot of it was following the market. I think that her first passion was for these science fiction genres, and The Last Man was a flop. So after that, she tried to chase the market. You know, Sir Walter Scott was writing at this point.
So was this a genre that was well established, or was she a kind of innovative? I guess I always assumed she was super innovative, and Frankenstein was like there's nothing like it ever before. Is that?
That's true of Frankenstein. There was a little bit of a vogue for last man narratives
really?
In the 1620s.
Did they feel like they were at the end of an era?
The 1820s.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of a vogue in the 1820s.
Uh-huh.
I think they did feel like they were at the end of an era. So first of all, they're just coming off this horrific Napoleonic War violence where huge parts of the European countryside are just decimated.
Mm.
And then in 1816, there was a volcano that exploded. And it basically, the ash blocked out the sun for an entire summer. So there were these just terrifying fears of the sun going out and that the apocalypse is here.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were quite a few people who wrote stories called The Last Man, including Lord Byron wrote a poem called Darkness about the sun going out. And she followed in those footsteps in ways that really angered male critics of her time. It was considered completely inappropriate for women to write about this kind of subject.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Does that explain why the flop, too, do you think?
I think
there was shocking to the audience?
Yeah, I think that was a big part of it. It was just considered too ugly.
For a woman's sensibilities.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
So then she changes and she goes on to write this more sort of historical and domestic fiction. But I see her as just a really important figure, not just for Frankenstein, but because we can trace through her writings a real understanding of how the culture was shifting from the early 19th century into the middle of the 19th century.
Can you say more about that? What kinds of shifts can we trace in her writing as mm-hmm. well as in the times?
So when she's writing Frankenstein, she's living predominantly among people who identify as atheists, which was actually quite a shocking position to adopt in that time period. For a long time, there was even a debate over whether atheists could even exist. And now suddenly there are people who are willing to claim that role, including her husband and her father. And we see those kinds of doubts in Frankenstein, right? If you look at Victor Frankenstein, the creator, mm-hmm. as a stand-in for God, he either is this sort of absent father, you know, or he is a malignant father, a father who has rejected his child. He wants to destroy his child. And that's sort of a profoundly disturbing idea that maybe God doesn't love us. Maybe God hates us or wants to flee from us, if God even exists at all.
Wow.
And we see a shift in her writings. The culture as a whole, I think, became more religious, but specifically evangelically inflected religious as we move further into the 19th century. And what we start to see in her later works, which have been considered much less by critics,
mm-hmm.
But what we start to see in her later works is more of an evangelically inflected understanding of the domestic sphere as holy.
Huh. Can you give an example or
sure.
help us understand that?
Yeah. I mean, the idea would be that in the end, it doesn't really matter what's going on with God or with nature or with the broader world, because what matters is love and the domestic sphere and family and human relationships.
Which also puts women in a different role, doesn't it?
It really does. I mean, it really, and this is one of the qualities of evangelical religion in the early 19th century, was this elevation of women's role within the home. That women are religious tutors, women create almost sort of a paradise within the home.
As against the hell of the public world? Or
the public world, the business world, the political realms. We can find this real solace inside the domestic sphere.
Both men and women can. Mm-hmm. Women are in charge of it, and men can be sort of restored before they go back out.
That's exactly right. Oh. Men can retreat to the domestic sphere. Mm-hmm. They can reestablish their inherent morality, their inherent goodness in the domestic sphere, and then they can go bring that out into the public world.
Huh. And so her writings reflected that. Is that the trajectory then, from a kind of atheist position mm-hmm. to a sacred domestic?
Yeah, that's how I would trace it. And it's interesting to think about her career as a whole, because critics so often, and our pop culture too, want to cut her off either at Frankenstein or right after Percy Shelley's death, when she's really in the throes of this sort of existential despair. And that's not the whole story for her.
And there's also these depictions of her, right, as this grieving widow. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, one of the things that has fascinated me in looking at the discourse about Mary Shelley is just the extent to which she's frozen in time at this moment. There are many paintings that were painted over the course of the 19th century that feature pictures of Mary Shelley mourning at his funeral. So there's this one painting from the Victorian era where the canvas focuses very heavily on his body during its cremation, but you see her kneeling in the corner of the canvas, mourning him all in black. This is historically inaccurate. She wasn't there for the funeral. And so it's fascinating to me that so many wanted to think about her as a mourner, and even her own son, when he commissioned the monument to her and his father after their deaths, he depicted her. It's a giant statue of Mary Shelley cradling Percy Shelley's body, Pietà style, right after his death. So there's this sort of cultural move. Which never happened. Oh. She never saw him before his cremation, after his death. So it's just this fascinating move to freeze her in this moment of eternal mourning. You know, A, that was not the entirety of her life. She went on to do so much more. But B, I think it's something that she herself was uncomfortable with. This idea of women as mourners, and that we idolize the idea of women when they're in mourning, that there's something pure and holy about that. And the quintessential example, if you've read Frankenstein, Frankenstein's father keeps a portrait of Frankenstein's mother, Caroline, over his mantelpiece. And it's a portrait of Caroline lying on her father's coffin, sobbing. And that's how he's chosen to memorialize his wife. And it's, you know, there's been a lot of work that's been done on the idea that the Victorians were really obsessed with death. But this isn't about being obsessed with death. This is about being obsessed with mourning.
Yes, yeah.
And I think that Mary Shelley saw that as problematic, as sort of confining women to this one moment of sadness.
And yet, that happened to her as posthumous reputation. You don't have any control after
exactly
you die
right.
over how you're
exactly.
represented.
Exactly.
Is there other work that's come out, other interesting stories from your Shelley work that you want to share?
One of the most interesting stories that I came across, which is not very well known, it's been discussed a little bit by French historians, but almost nothing in terms of English history, was this little known, it was the last witch trial in France in the 1730s, which actually is relevant to Mary Shelley, as we'll see. It was a woman named Mary Catherine Cadière. She was known for her piety in the 1730s, and she was training to be a nun and working with this one priest, a man named Father Girard. And depending on whose story you believe, he either raped her, impregnated her, forced her to have an abortion, horrible things. Mm-hmm. Or you believe that she seduced him and was actually a witch.
Hmm.
And so it goes to trial. It's this very, very long, protracted trial that happens in France over a very long period of time. And ultimately, there were 12 jurors, 6 found in her favor, 6 found in his favor. So neither was convicted. Huh. And they sort of disappeared out of the annals of history. What's interesting about this is this story, which we've not heard of at all today, had really important literary resonance throughout the 18th century. There were several plays that were written about this trial in England. It shows up in a couple of Gothic novels of the period, most famous one being The Monk. And for my purposes, I think that Mary Shelley was adapting it into this novel that she writes later in her life called Valperga. Mm-hmm. And for Mary Shelley, I think what she was very interested in is this idea of, A, to what extent can we believe women's testimony? If a woman says, this is my experience, how do we believe her? Something that's obviously important question right
very
now.
Very timely, yes.
Yeah. And secondly, it's, I think for Mary Shelley, it was this very important question about women and religion. What role can women have in religion? This woman,
because women at the time did not have much of a role, right? Except as nuns or what?
Well, it depended, actually. Mm. In until about 1803, in Methodism, women were allowed to preach. Mm. And there were quite a few women in the early 19th century during the Napoleonic Wars who established themselves as prophets. There's one named Joanna Southcott who actually sold about 100,000 copies of her works. She was the second best-selling author of the day after Lord Byron.
Wow.
Yeah, and I mean, they're just these very strange prophecies. She was a laundress, and in her 50s or 60s, she decided that she was giving birth to the new Messiah and wrote down her prophecies.
Goodness.
Yeah, so, I mean, you have this question of not just women's testimony, but how can women participate in religion, and to what extent are women's voices valid in expressing these prophecies? And that's why I think that she went back to this case. Mary Catherine Cotier had followers who believed that she was semi-divine. And that she wasn't a witch, that she was divinely inspired in prophesying.
Ah.
Yeah.
That is interesting. Mm-hmm. So what are you working on right now? Are you done with the Shelley work and moving on?
I am mostly done with the Shelley work. Yep, the book is in, so that's exciting. Probably some copy editing and things like that to go, but it's mostly done. I have two projects that I'm working on right now. The first is I'm very interested in an author, little-known author of the late 18th century named Charlotte Dacre.
Mm-hmm.
She was a very scandalous figure in the time period. Her father was actually a very famous Jewish moneylender, so she was sort of a cultural outsider religiously. She had several children out of wedlock, and she was known for writing these very disturbing, violent Gothic novels in a time period where that wasn't appropriate for women. There's been some work that's been done on one of her novels. It's called Zofloya. It's one of the first zombie novels. It's great.
Zombie novel.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. But I'm hoping to bring out an edition of one of her other novels called The Passions, which features one of the greatest female villains of all time. Her name is Apollonia Zulmer, and she is going to get her revenge on all of the men who have done her wrong. So it's sort of a fascinating.
And it's not available now? You're helping make it available.
I would be helping to make it available. It just doesn't exist in modern form.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's the first project. The second project I'm interested in is, given sort of where we are culturally and thinking about this concept of cultural trauma, I want to return, I think, to the 17th century for the next project and think about the trauma of the English Civil War and thinking about it as trauma. You know, we often talk about the First World War as being the moment where we start talking about shell shock and PTSD in its modern form, and obviously that's true, but these older events were just as traumatizing individually and culturally as the world wars have been for our culture. So I'd like to return there and think about those issues.
So let's move from what you have done to sort of how you do what you do, and that might be a place to start. So in this project that you have in mind, how would you research that? How will you find the evidence you need to do your research?
Sure. Some of it will come from, you know, the sort of published literary sources that we all know. So looking at the Earl of Rochester's poetry, for instance, who we know him mostly nowadays, if you know him, for sort of writing sexy, libertine, witty poetry. But he's somebody that was a raging alcoholic, by our standards was molested as a 12-year-old, watched several of his friends blown up in battle next to him. And so I'd like to go back to that poetry and look at it through the lens of the expression of trauma rather than through the sort of sexy libertine poetry lens that it's been considered as.
So am I hearing right that much of your work is a rereading through a lens that takes the cliches or stereotypes that may be operating and complexifies how we understand particular figures, especially by making connections to the time, between the text and the times?
I think that's right. A lot of what I'm very interested in doing is taking texts that you wouldn't also consider as literature and then reading them alongside literary texts.
Ah, so making the connection between a popular culture form and what we now call high culture.
Exactly. Like, so you look at these scandal tracts that were coming out, or propaganda pamphlets, or religious sermons, things that are not necessarily sort of traditional literature. And then you say, how do these extra literary documents, these non-literature documents, create a culture to which the literature is responding?
Yeah. Can you say a little bit more? I always like to ask our guests about the joys of research as well as the less pleasant mm-hmm. aspects. So can you tell more about, you know, what makes the research fun for you?
You know, there's nothing that beats the experience of opening a document, whether it's something that you find online or if you're lucky enough to be able to travel and view it in person, to be able to open these boxes and touch these materials from the 1600s. You know, when I was working on the first book, I had the opportunity to go to the National Archives in Britain and look through actual depositions from criminal trials. And you open these boxes, and I mean, these are real people's stories that you're looking at. It's unbelievable.
Handwritten with ink and
not fountain pens,
of quills. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. With handwriting, that's very difficult to decipher at first. First, when I opened, I said to myself, wait, it's not typewritten? you know, so you get to just, there's just an aura to these documents that you can't beat. And then, you know, that aha moment when you make that connection.
Between the time and the texts or different mm-hmm. texts, or you re-see things, I suppose,
I think
too.
That's exactly a good way to think of it. You think of when you have a text that you've read in so many different ways, and you find something that makes you look at it in a whole different way. Like understanding the Cadière trial really changes your understanding of what Shelley's doing in Valperga and how she understands religion. It's an amazing feeling. And if you're lucky, you actually get to travel to do it. You actually get to go to archives. And, you know, I got to spend a month in Chatham House Library in Britain to work on the Shelley project, which was amazing.
They let you touch these and you just take notes and ponder and think about them and then try to make those connections for the reader.
Mm-hmm. I think that's exactly right. And of course, you know, try to share your results with other scholars and with other people and go to conferences and present so that you can get feedback on your work. It can be a very solitary profession. I mean, that's one of the downsides of scholarship, perhaps. So it's good to sort of bring your research out of your office through venues like this, for instance,
right?
And be able to actually talk to people and say that, you know, what I'm doing actually is not just interesting, but important for understanding.
Well, let's move to that, because I think it's mm-hmm. easy for people to dismiss, like, what's the point of reading all these? Mm-hmm. Well, that was then, this is now. Mm-hmm. So what do you say to people who think that it's a waste of time to mm-hmm. know more about these historical figures and the work mm-hmm. that they've done?
I don't think we can fully understand how we got to where we are until we understand where we came from. Mm-hmm. That's probably cliched to say that, but I think it's absolutely true. Reading all of these propaganda tracts from the 1640s and 50s, you realize how little things have changed.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
You know, the types of themes that come up in propaganda stay the same. It's just the target that shifts.
Can you say more about that?
So you'll read a tract that talks about an anti-Semitic tract that demonizes Jewish people by saying that they're going to kill Christian babies and grind them up into matzah. But then you'll read an anti-Catholic tract that demonizes Catholics by saying they're going to grind Protestant babies up and make them into communion wafers. And so what you just see is this consistent sort of stable of images, sexual assault, property crime, in some cases cannibalism, that get
ascribed to the other group.
Ascribed to whoever the other is. And that doesn't change. Another one that comes up a lot and that still comes up, right? I mean, is the idea of images of monarchs that overreach themselves by committing acts of sexual violence. In this time period, the monarch is supposed to be seen as absolute. And they're debating the extent to which the monarch is supposed to be absolute. And increasingly what they say is, well, no, maybe sexual assault is the limit of the monarch's authority. If the monarch commits a rape, he can't stay the monarch. And that's certainly something that we're debating in our own cultural moment, right? On both sides of the aisles, you know, discussion about Donald Trump, discussion about Bill Clinton. These issues are still coming up and we're still using women's bodies as metaphors for political movements, in a sense.
And as you mentioned, the believability of women's mm-hmm. testimony.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what's appropriate or inappropriate, women's expressions of mm-hmm. anger, those kinds of things, too.
And how can you ever really conclusively prove you said no? You know, when I teach these subjects in class, I talk a lot about what I call the chastity force field.
Say more about that.
So it's this idea that if a woman is only chaste enough, if she really, really doesn't want it, something will happen to save her from sexual assault. And it can be very, I mean, in some of these 17th century tracts, it's literally a comet comes down from God and kills the rapist.
And so if a comet doesn't come, it must mean she wanted
exactly,
it.
Exactly.
Oh.
So her chastity force field failed. So how can we ever know that she didn't want it?
Ugh.
So just another way of coming at the contemporary relevance for the work mm-hmm. you do would be the teaching that you mm-hmm. do. So can you say more about which classes and what your students seem to be responding to mm-hmm. from these themes that your work covers?
I actually just recently taught a whole class devoted to images of sexual assault. This was maybe a semester ago, so the political climate has changed since then. But it was really interesting for students to start back in the 17th and 18th century, even a little further back with Shakespeare and the Rape of Lucrece, and see the extent to which things actually haven't changed all that much. We like to think things are getting better, but the number of people convicted now is not significantly different than the numbers and the percentage of people being convicted in the 18th century. And that's sort of a shocking thing. I mean, another example of that is in 1696, one-third of the plays performed on the British stage were written by women.
Really?
And we have never, in the 21st century or the 20th century, come anywhere close to that. So I enjoy talking with my students about the relationship between older literature and then modern popular culture. I shift back and forth between teaching courses on old literature and then on modern things. But I teach a lot of classes on early modern drama and on propaganda and the playhouse, and so that students can get a really good grounding in how to be archival researchers themselves.
So what makes a good archival researcher? What's your sense of how it's well done and how it's poorly done?
So for how it's well done, I think sort of just a general curiosity is important. These archives are not well organized. I mean, some of them are well marked, but you don't always know what you're going to be looking at. If you go in person, you might just get a box and you can open the box and you don't know what's in it. It's never been cataloged. So you have to be willing to just sort of get dirty, uh-huh. sometimes literally, and go through the materials and say to yourself, what do I see? What's interesting?
And also to be aware that you only have a partial story, right? What's missing from these archives?
Exactly. A lot of stuff is not extant anymore. It doesn't exist. When I looked at these trial depositions, only one of the circuit courts, only one of their records still exists. So there's a lot that's been lost. So I think that general intellectual curiosity is important. I think a general willingness to move back and forth between things that are traditional literature and then things that we can still analyze as literature, even though they weren't meant in that way, is important.
And so bad archival work would be ones that don't sort of understand the context and, overinterpret, make wild claims not based on the evidence?
Or try to force things based on a couple of examples. I saw a few examples of this, so it must all be that way. It's a complicated culture, right? I mean, for every person that was a royalist, there was a person that was a parliamentarian, right? And so if you try to assume that all people of the 18th century felt this way, you're going to get into trouble.
So we have to be careful with these sweeping generalizations mm-hmm. and taking a few examples and mm-hmm. making them stand for the whole period.
Exactly.
So it's kind of a nuance that a good mm-hmm. archivist will always be aware of.
Right. I think that's
that
absolutely
complexity.
Right.
Mm-hmm. If readers are interested in the kinds of work that you do, what mm-hmm. do you recommend they look for as resources?
Well, to start off with, I really hope they'll check out Tulsa Studies in Women's Literature, which is the journal that I've been fortunate enough to edit for the past few years. We were the first, as you said, the first journal devoted solely to the study of women's literature.
Started here at the University of Tulsa.
Started here at the University of Tulsa in the 1980s, still mm-hmm. going strong. And we publish really just the best in literary criticism of women's literature. So
all of women's writing is available. So any scholar interested in women's writing, this would be a place where they could publish their mm-hmm. research. And it's, innovative and new research, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
absolutely.
Great source.
I'd also make a pitch for the Afrobane Society, which mm-hmm. I'm the president of. It's a scholarly society dedicated to the study of women in the arts. In the long 18th century.
Named after the first female playwright?
Named after the first female playwright. And, we do a lot of outreach. We have a journal, ABO, Afrobane Online, and which publishes scholarship. And then also ABO Public, which is dedicated to reaching a broader audience, a non-scholarly audience, with stories about the long 18th century. So it's a good place to check out.
Well, thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Jolie Jensen, and this has been Found It to You, a monthly podcast produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa on the TU campus. We've been talking with Dr. Jennifer Airy, Associate Professor of English, about her research, and we ask you to join us next month for another chance to hear a University of Tulsa faculty member discuss, in everyday language, the nature and value of their research. Thank you for being with us, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for having me.